Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn. Archaeological data suggests the Aceh Indians lived and hunted throughout the Atlantic rainforest in eastern Paraguay for thousands of years. Now they are cornered near a shrinking region of the endangered forest, the Yumbarda-Kaju Nature Reserve. It is rich in biodiversity and hosts several species threatened with extinction. The Aceh are well suited for the job of protecting the forest, but they face constant battles over the land. Salt Lake City resident Kevin Jones lived among the Aceh in the early 1980s when he was working on his PhD in anthropology at the University of Utah. The experience changed his life perspective. Today on the program, Jones talks to producer Susie Montgomery about his new book inspired by the Aceh called The Shrinking Jungle.
I'm an anthropologist and an archaeologist, and I've been an archaeologist in this intermountain region for 30 years. And I had a great opportunity when I was in graduate school at University of Utah in the early 1980s to go to South America and live among hunter-gatherers who lived in the mountains of Paraguay. One of my colleagues was a student named Kim Hill, who's now a professor at Arizona State, who had lived among these people as a Peace Corps volunteer and had an inn with them. And we went down and did ethnographic and ethno-archaeological work, which was what I did. And I'd never been in lowland South America, you know, never been among people like that. The whole experience was a life-changing one for me. Meeting these people who lived until just a few years before that, completely as hunter-gatherers, uncontacted, but by peaceful contact with the European world, with the modern world, to spend time with these people and see how they organized their lives and how they went about obtaining subsistence and sheltering themselves and taking care of their kids was unbelievable to me. It was just one of the most amazing things that I ever experienced.
What year was this, and what exactly was unbelievable?
This was in the early 1980s. Just to see the way they understood the jungle, understood the forest, knew the plants and animals intimately, more than I knew anything in the world, and knew how to live there in a place that was one of the most harsh places I've ever been. This was a place that, and I was a hiker and a camper and outdoorsy. I think if I had been left behind by one of the bands that I was with in the forest, I would have lasted maybe the rest of the afternoon. You know, this is a rough place.
What would have gotten you, you think?
Snakes, jaguars. I wouldn't have found anything. I would have eaten the poisonous berries. I don't know. You know, I was as completely out of my element as. And I thought about this when I was in the forest, as if I had taken one of the Aceh and just dropped him off in the middle of a street in an urban area. They wouldn't have known anything about, you know, how to get around or anything like that. But this, by the same token, I was just as lost in that forest. But also what really struck me was the stories of the lives of the people that I lived with. And now they had come from being full-time hunter-gatherers basically in the Stone Age and confronted directly the 20th century within their lifetimes and had come from the Stone Age to the 20th century in a very, very short amount of time. I mean, they'd been at war with people with shotguns and rifles, and they had bows and arrows that they made out of hardwood trees and palm trees. So just the stories that they told were pretty phenomenal. And I felt really privileged to have an opportunity to talk with people, to get to know people who lived in this way, because all of our ancestors lived as hunter-gatherers for many hundreds of thousands of years. I mean, we are hunter-gatherers. That's how we evolved. We evolved in that context. Our social organizations, our physical skills, our abilities, our spirituality, our music, our mental capacity, our social skills, all evolved around a fire with other people who were getting up every morning and hunting and gathering for our subsistence. This is a way of life that is common to all of us for much, much longer time than we've been farming and living in houses.
So, and it seems that you're saying you could feel that in yourself when you were there.
I knew it. It's sort of like staring into a fire. I mean, I've had this experience many times camping. When we sit around a fire, it doesn't matter if you're the most urban person or the most rural person, when you're out in a field and you're sitting with friends and it's night and you have a fire going, everyone is drawn to that fire. Your gaze goes to the fire. The fire cements us together. The fire comforts us. The fire entertains us. The fire is a magnet for us. Mm-hmm. And that, I believe, is basically something that's wired into our nervous systems for many hundreds of thousands of years, of that being the thing that warmed us, that helped us, that kept away bad guys and enemies. And the feeling of being with people who were so close to the natural world, sitting around campfires with them in the middle of the jungle, the frightening and scary jungle, really struck a chord with me and really helped me understand that this is who we all were very, very recently.
I also had the lucky opportunity to visit the Aché and camp with them in the forest. Here's an excerpt of my report on the Kwaituve Aché and their efforts to save their rainforest, their ancestral homeland. I spent a few early winter nights in the rainforest in eastern Paraguay with a group of 20 Aché men, women, and children, and it wasn't romantic. We ate fox, rodents, nuts and berries, and insect larvae roasted on sticks like marshmallows. The last night, the Aché men came back to camp with two dead monkeys and an armadillo. The eldest woman chopped up the armadillo and burned the hair off the monkeys and cooked them over the small campfire. She boiled the monkey heads. Everyone shared the feast. Nothing was wasted. Even the monkey heads were licked clean and the brains were scooped out with a twig and savored. Kim Hill, professor of anthropology at Arizona State University, has known the Aché for 30 years. He first encountered the Aché while serving in the Peace Corps in Paraguay in 1978. Now he is their close friend and advocate.
You get used to it or you die, but you think in the middle that you're probably going to die before you get used to it, because you get more and more mosquito bites, and sometimes you can have a great big scab, open, pussy wound on your leg within a week of going to the forest that started as a little tick bite, and sleeping with kids crawling all over you at night, sleep deprivation sets in and you feel exhausted after about 10 days of eating nothing but meat and insect larvae. You're like, oh my God, I can't stand another piece of meat.
The Aché are especially well-suited to this environment, and in it they thrive like superheroes. Barefoot, they move swiftly through dense and prickly tick-infested terrain. The men can jog several hours a day through the forest with bows and arrows hunting wild game. A seasoned marathon runner would have a hard time keeping up. The women and young girls carry heavy hand-woven baskets filled with clothes and supplies on their backs and heads. When they find a spot to camp for the night, hours are spent sitting around a few plate-sized campfires.
The Aché are really kind of happy-go-lucky people in their attitude. They love to joke and laugh and sing and smile all the time. I mean, there's a deeper side to them, too. They don't show it usually to people unless they know them really well. There's definitely cases of depression.
Magdalena Hurtado, professor of anthropology at Arizona State University, married Kim Hill when they were both graduate students in anthropology at the University of Utah in the early 1980s. They have three daughters who often joined them on field trips to Paraguay to live with the Aché. Like her husband, Hurtado has dedicated her life to helping the Aché.
What I love most about the Aché is their interpersonal interactions. Their whole idea that it's really important to forgive and understand others when they do things that are harmful. But the process of forgiveness is you forgive, but you also expect the other person to come completely clean.
There are about 1,200 Aché Indians living in several different villages and regions of the forest. They farm small crops, including corn, peanuts, and manioc, but hunting and gathering is still a prized part of life. The Embarcadero Reserve is a chunk of forest about the size of Connecticut, adjacent to where the Aché live. It was established as a nature preserve in 1991 as a result of efforts sparked by Hill and Hurtado. The Aché help protect and manage the reserve as conservationists and park guards. They are the only group with legal rights to use the reserve, but only according to their traditional hunting and gathering methods. The Ambarctica Jewel Reserve is a national jewel, but it's also a treasure chest where predators abound. The main intruders are marijuana and soy farmers, illegal hunters and poachers, loggers, and landless peasants called campesinos who try to invade the Aceh territory, sometimes igniting fierce battles that often result in one or two deaths.
The animals are disappearing at an incredibly rapid rate, and nothing is being done about it, and nothing has been done about it for years. The reserve is supposed to be the Aceh supermarket, but when somebody leaves the door wide open to your supermarket and lets everybody come in and steal everything they want, you don't get anything out of it anymore, and so obviously the Aceh are really unhappy about the situation.
The reserve is governed by the United Nations, funded by international conservation groups, and subject to international law. But Paraguay is a culture where lawlessness presides. Lucy Aquino is the director of the World Wildlife Fund in Paraguay.
Here is a culture of impunity and corruption and threats, and how can you work that way? That's why we, as an international conservation organization, rather to work with NGOs and people from the government.
Back at camp, it's nightfall, and the Aceh are huddled together on the damp forest floor. Their smiling faces are lit by the soft light of the campfires. Unexpectedly, the eldest man starts singing an old traditional Aceh song. He inspired his wife to sing, too. It's an art form that's dying along with the forest.
The things that I experienced there were profoundly moving to me, and on many different levels, intellectually very much so, but also on other levels. And I wanted to be able to tell those stories. I wanted to be able to come back and tell that story to my mother and to tell about these people to my neighbors. But I didn't have a very good way of doing that. And I did write the scientific work that I did, which is jargony and very important in the scientific sense, but not readable by a regular person. I could have tried to write a typical ethnography, which is sort of a descriptive way of writing about people. Those tend to not be real readable either. They tend to be sort of like, you know, a report on the way the so-and-so do something, and those are not very exciting. And I couldn't think of any better way to do it, so I just started making up a fictitious band, you know, using kind of the characters and the people that I knew, and trying to write a story of the way they lived and some of their stories in the context of a fictional bunch of characters.
So who's the main character in your book?
Main character is a kid. Main character is a kid named Catfish. He's about a 9-year-old boy. I can tell you why the main character is a boy, a 9-year-old boy, because when I was among the Aceh, I hung out with the kids a whole lot. I was in my 30s, but I hung out with the kids a whole lot because the kids, well, kids are not all tied up and don't have busy things to do all day, like watch other kids or go out and hunt and so forth. And kids are very tolerant of people who don't speak the language very well. They're very accepting. So I learned a whole lot from the kids. I hung out with the kids, and I really enjoyed them, and I made very good friends with young boys and young girls. And
were they different from other 9-year-old boys, let's say?
I felt that if I would have been interjected into that situation when I was 9 years old, I would have been exactly like those kids. In fact, I felt the whole time that the way of life of these people, any of us would be that way if we were in that circumstance. They were doing the thing that any of us would do if we had the skills and the knowledge to live in that circumstance. And it's not told from his perspective, but he's really the one that we follow throughout. And his family, his little nuclear family, his parents, and they're all based on people I know. I'm real happy with the way it turned out.
Where'd you get the name Catfish?
Well, all Aceh are named for an animal. All Aceh are named for an animal that their mother prepared for a meal sometime while she was pregnant with them. And for some reason, that animal stuck out in her mind. That was a significant event happened, or there was some significance to it, and she chooses that name for her child. So they all, everyone has an animal name, and they actually have a suffix that's attached to the animal name, so you know that you're not just talking about a catfish, but you're talking about the boy named Catfish.
And what's your Aceh name?
Kriegi, and it's for a kind of armadillo. They just decided when I was down there that should be my name, so.
In fact, the Aceh gave me a name too, Jacugi, which means wild turkey. And I had a similar experience with the children. They were my happy guides.
the story starts with an event that I heard about happening, that happened in the 1960s, some point, in which an Aceh band is attacked early in the morning by a bunch of peasant farmers, and they've somehow tracked this band into the forest and surrounded them and attacked the band and killed some of them, and the rest of the band ran off into the forest. They've lost everything. They've lost all of their belongings, and they've just gotten away with their lives. And so the band of about 25 people has to reconstitute itself. They have to, you know, gather themselves together and recreate their technology. So they have to rebuild what they had and find a new place to hunt and to live. And so we follow them through the course of rebuilding their lives. And so in the course of that, I tell you how they make their mats, how they make their bows, how they build their houses when they build houses, how they organize their camps and things, which is one of the things I wanted to try to do, is sort of explain those things, how they did things.
So it doesn't get lost forever kind of thing.
Yeah, and I tried to make it in a way that it's integral to the story, so that it's not just a dry description of how to build a shelter in the jungle. But, I mean, if you're interested in how Aceh build shelters, it's in the book.
You know, I just remember a story you once telling me. And as you say, going into foreign places and trying to sort of adapt and learn from different perspectives and how people different people live. And at that time you were doing that, you had quite a major accident that has almost become, as a musician, as you've had to overcome the losing of your thumb. Can you tell that story?
It was one of my trips in Paraguay. Yeah, we were in a bad car crash in rural Paraguay. Our vehicle sideswiped a bus going the opposite direction, and we rolled down the middle of the road, and my hand was basically torn to shreds, my right hand. And we had to hitchhike into town and find a hospital, and did, finally, eventually. It was a Toyota Land Cruiser station wagon, and I crawled out of the upside-down car through the windshield, and I felt something kind of dangling, and I looked down, and it was a big chunk of my hand that had been ripped off from the rest of it and was just hanging by some strings and things. I thought, oh, geez, that's not very good. And a lady was standing nearby who'd gotten off the bus that we'd hit and handed me a cloth and wrapped it up.
Thumb included?
Yeah, yeah, all the parts.
Jones and Hill were then offered a ride to the hospital by a Paraguayan man in the area. Their misfortune was not over yet.
I started feeling hot, and I thought, oh, this isn't good. I'm not feeling that well. And then I realized there were fumes coming up through the floorboards, and I said, I think your car's on fire. And he had to stop the car, and there were some wires that were on fire in the car, so they had to put the fire out.
Jones eventually made it to the hospital and had to return to the States early to mend his wounds.
So I find this really interesting. So are you a scientist first, a musician second, an author third? And what inspired you to delve into storytelling? This is your first novel, published novel, is that right?
Yes.
It's not your first publication. I worked with you in the late 90s. And as a volunteer, I was working with you on a really oversized, glossy, full-color interactive magazine, science magazine for kids, that also was accompanied by a TV series similar to Nickelodeon-style TV series. Since I've known you, you've been an incredibly innovative guy who's really committed to storytelling. At the time, you were the state archaeologist and you were, you know, not typical, I would say. Why is these stories coming out of you? Where do they come from?
I'm real curious about the world. And the way I understand things in the world is as they relate to other things, as they're part of, part and parcel of something. So if I'm learning about any one thing, I don't just learn about that thing in itself. I learn about, you know, its place in geography and time and other things, and that lends to filling it in as a story. The richness of everything has a story, even if it's a rock. Where does this rock come from? Well, there is a long history to that. But also, part of it is related to my desire to tell this story. I find the world to be a very interesting place. I'm enthralled by almost everything, and I like sharing that. So I enjoy writing, especially for kids, especially for young people. I really enjoy writing about the archaeology that I do. I find the archaeology that I've done through my life extraordinarily interesting. Unfortunately, in some ways, when you're a scientist, a lot of the ways that you report on the stuff that you do is not real interesting unless you know a whole lot about it. Science is filled with jargon and special language that we use, scientists use to talk to each other. It doesn't mean we're not excited about what we're talking about. We are, but we're telling a story that's only accessible to a small number of people who have that same background and all that information that you do. But there are a lot of other people who are interested in the archaeology as well, and I need to be able to write it for them if I want to tell them about it. So you write it in a different way, that's all. It doesn't make it any less scientific or valuable. But I think that, for one thing, I mean, in writing for kids and talking about doing Zinge Magazine and Zinge TV, I think a lot of what people have done for kids in terms of educational stuff about science is right down to them. They oversimplify and make science silly. And I don't think that's the way to learn things. I don't think you learn by anything by making it silly. But you can write about things in ways that make it interesting and fun. And I have fun learning and I have fun writing about things that I learn about. I'm not sure I'm the best writer in the world, but I'm an enthusiastic writer.
So I brought up the scientist, the musician, and now author goes beside your name. Are you going to continue writing, and are you going to continue science, music, and writing, and in what capacity?
I think I'm condemned to do all those things. I don't think I can get away from them very easily. I love playing music. I've always played music, whether I play in a band or I'm just sitting on my back porch playing and singing for my dogs. But I'll always do that. And writing, I've always written, like any published author. I have trunks full of notebooks, full of stuff that I've scribbled down over the years and written down. Lots of it is meaningless to anyone but me, but I'm sort of compulsive about that, and I'm a compulsive note taker and a story writer, and I continue to write fiction, and I continue to write nonfiction, and I continue to write songs and play songs, and having a pretty big old time working on all those things.
Awesome.
Got blind and came, turned lights back on. We learned the shot, all the meat was gone.
Kevin Jones plays the mandolin and performs vocals for the bluegrass band, The Lab Dogs.
Because you started your book right after your ethnographic sort of experience in Paraguay, and you just published it.
Came out in October 2012. I really completed this novel in its basic form in 1988. I actually tried for a little while to get it published at the time. I sent it around to a few publishers and agents and really didn't get any real interest in it. I took a new job, had a child, sort of just set it on the shelf for a real long time. And it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I was talking with one of the editors at University of Utah Press and told her about the book. And she said, well, send it to me and we'll see. I'll be glad to take a look at it. And did, and had it reviewed and got good positive responses to it, so she decided to publish it. So I'm very happy about that.
There's some really serious issues happening to the Aché in Paraguay right now in terms of a land struggle. Can you just talk to that and how the publishing of this book is actually quite timely with perhaps the demise of the entire culture?
Well, the Aché people didn't go away when I stopped, you know, working with them ethnographically. In fact, Kim Hill continues to go down and work with them and has now for 30-some years. But they're struggling. They came out of the forest as second-class citizens and were treated poorly by the locals and had no land. They had no, you know, they had no inheritance. They had no way of knowing how to deal with the modern world. And gradually they've been trying to establish themselves, and they've organized somewhat and have tried to obtain some land that they could use in a traditional way, and they have. They just recently, in 2012, the government granted the tribe a deed to a fairly substantial piece of land of their traditional traditional land. There's been lots of controversy since then. There are local campesinos, squatters, who've been trying to use that land. There's potential for armed conflict. So there's a lot of tension in the area of competition for the traditional hunting lands of the Aceh. And they are working with some companies. One of them is called Guayaki, which makes herbal teas, and especially yerba mate, which is a traditional drink of Paraguay. And they're growing shade-grown, natural, organic yerba mate on the Aceh lands, and Aceh are helping to harvest it and cure it and sell it. So there is an opportunity for economic development for them, but their lands are being threatened. They're in a tough spot right now, and I'm hoping maybe that by publishing this book, I can at least raise the conversation up a little bit, let people know that this situation is transpiring, and maybe there's some ways that we can draw some attention to it and help out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. This seems like, you know, it's a smaller story of the Aceh group, but it's analogous to so many situations across the world of people fighting for traditional land and traditional lifestyle. So I feel like, you know, it joins a bigger conversation, and most people haven't heard of the Aceh, but
it's a story that's repeated over and over again everywhere in the world, and what's compounding it in this area is the deforestation that comes along with modern incursion into that forest. And many of the forests that I traveled with the Aceh in and foraged in the early 1980s are no longer forests anymore. They've been cut down and turned into pastureland or farmland. So that whole ecosystem is dramatically altered by human hands, and it's part of the ongoing deforestation of the tropics. In many ways, it's a large-scale ecological disaster that's going on, but it's also very understandable. I mean, those trees aren't being cut down really by multinational corporations. They're being cut down one at a time by people who are trying to grow a garden and feed their children. So it's, you know, it's not something that's easily understood or fought politically. There's a lot of competition for the land, and there probably always will be. I'm hoping the Aceh can maintain some lands that they can use collectively and help to provide an economic base for themselves, because they've been there forever and have used that land very well for many, many thousands of years. I hope they can continue to have a little bit of a say in how the land is used.
You would say that you have an emotional tie to this group.
Yeah, I do have an attachment to them. They're people I know. I have a personal connection. And I do care about their well-being. I do care about their economic and physical health. And I want to see them move into the modern world in a way that doesn't completely destroy them.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about yourself through writing this book, or even your experience with them? Other than maybe the fact that you can't survive in every environment without a little bit of time and practice.
I think you learn about yourself by putting yourself in situations that are different than the ones that you're accustomed to. I think we grow by traveling, and by traveling, and I don't necessarily just mean going places, but I mean seeing different places and experiencing different places and meeting people who live and look at the world in very different ways than you do. I think we learn more about ourselves doing that than in almost anything that we can do. I think travel and living among other people is the best cure for ethnocentrism and bigotry that we can have. And it helps us also to understand that our way isn't the best, necessarily. The appeal of the book is that you learn about people in a culture that's different from ours, but also you learn about something that's not going to be around very much longer, is the hunter-gatherer way of life. And it's something that's common to all of us. It's common to all of our ancestors. For many hundreds of thousands of years, we lived as hunter-gatherers. So it's a way to learn about that. And for better or for worse, I experienced that life way with these people. I didn't just make this up. I mean, there are a lot of people who have written books about cavemen and things like that, but they just made it all up. It's all made up. This one, warts and all, this is what living like a hunter-gatherer is like, and I'm pretty happy with the way the story came out. So.
Well, congratulations on the publication of this book. All right, thanks.
Kevin Jones was the State of Utah archaeologist for 20 years, and he continues to work in the field and play music.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor, with production support by Clint Holgate. Thank you for listening.
Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn how one man turned his personal passion for skiing into a long-standing and thriving family business. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Like many Utahns, Harold Seeholzer loved snow and skiing. But how did his enthusiasm for outdoor recreation turn into one of Cache Valley's most notable ski resorts? In the late 1930s, Harold and a few local ski fanatics engineered the first rope tow lift at Beaver Mountain near the top of Logan Canyon. Although the canyon was open to year-round traffic in 1939, Beaver Mountain appealed only to the most determined skiers. There was no road into Beaver Mountain, so skiers parked on the main highway and hiked in about a mile. The motor for the lift was also at the top of the mountain, so every morning someone had to hike up to start it. Because of these difficulties, the ski operation eventually moved to the nearby Sinks area, until it too closed down in 1945. But Harold and his wife Luella were determined to create a winter recreation area for families, so made another pitch for Beaver Mountain in the late 1940s. With the help from the Cache County Commission, funding was found to build a road and parking lot to make the area accessible. Rope tow and T-bar lifts were installed thanks to support from the Mount Logan Ski Club, the Forest Service, the Cache Chamber of Commerce, as well as personal funding from Harold and Luella. The Beaver Mountain Ski Resort was well underway by 1950. In 1961, Harold and Luella brought their children into the family business and continued to add lifts, runs, and buildings. However, one goal remained unfulfilled. From the beginning of his skiing career, Harold dreamed of having a chairlift rise from the base of Beaver Mountain to its peak. He died in 1968 before this could be accomplished, but within 2 years, his family opened just such a chairlift. Appropriately, they named it Harry's Dream. Today, Harold Seeholzer's Beaver Mountain Ski Resort is the oldest family-run ski operation in the country. Content for this episode of the Beehive Archive was provided by the Stokes Nature Center in Logan Canyon. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan.